You know, it's a really strange feeling to walk through the exact same physical space as someone else, like a partner or a sister or just a close friend.
Oh, absolutely.
And suddenly you realize
Okay.
that you are actually living in two entirely different worlds. Like you're walking down the exact same street, grabbing a coffee at the same cafe, but the internal map you're each using to navigate that space is completely different.
Yeah, the baseline reality is just completely split.
Right. And today we are unpacking a source that tries to, well, bridge that exact divide. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at excerpts from a 40-lesson course created by a social enterprise called HeySSL, and it's titled A Man's Guide to Discussing Harassment.
And, the stated mission of this material is quite specific. It presents a step-by-step communication framework aimed primarily at helping men open up conversations about harassment. The goal is to better understand the lived experiences and really that invisible mental load carried by women.
Yeah, and as always with our deep dives, we aren't here to endorse the course itself or, tell you what to think about it. Our goal is impartially to pull apart the mechanics of the framework they're presenting to see what behavioral insights and practical tools it actually offers for anyone looking to navigate these conversations.
Exactly. And the text is explicit that this isn't guidance on how to respond immediately after an acute traumatic incident.
Right.
It's pitched as an everyday communication toolkit.
Okay, let's unpack this because reading through the guide, it sets up the premise that dealing with harassment isn't just about learning statistics. The claim is that understanding this issue requires fundamentally altering the baseline way you listen and engage with the people you care about.
Right. And to get to that communication framework, the source first requires the reader to understand the structural barriers that are preventing open dialogue in the first place.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. The overarching question the text poses is, well, if harassment is as pervasive as the data suggests, why do so many people never hear about it from their own friends and family?
Right, because the assumption many people make is that a lack of disclosure just means an absence of incidents. Like, if I don't hear about it, it's not happening.
Precisely. And the HeySSL material attacks that assumption using some pretty heavy data.
Yeah, they cite a UN women's statistic indicating that globally, almost one in three women have experienced physical and/or sexual violence at least once in their life.
Which is a staggering number.
It is. But then they quickly contextualized that number by introducing their own global survey data. And they found that 69% of people never report harassment.
Wow.
And of those who do take the step to report it, 75% say they received absolutely no support afterward.
Yeah, and the material uses those numbers to explain the mechanics of silence. Silence, according to the source, is actually an evolutionary survival mechanism.
Wait, really? Survival?
Yeah, so when someone experiences a boundary violation, their brain immediately calculates the risks of speaking up, and the primary deterrent is the fear of not being believed.
Which is magnified if the harasser holds, like, social or professional power.
Exactly. Then there's the anticipation of judgment or blame. The guide points to that persistent cultural habit of asking questions like, well, what were you wearing? Or how much were you drinking?
Oh, right. The classic victim-blaming questions.
Right, because those questions shift the analytical focus from the perpetrator's actions directly onto the target's behavior.
You know, it sounds like we're dealing with an iceberg of an issue here. Like the reported statistics, the incidents that make the local news, formal HR complaints, that's just the visible tip above the water.
Exactly.
But there's this massive hidden underbelly of daily incidents, being followed, enduring intrusive staring, navigating aggressive passing comments, and all of that is kept completely submerged by a broader culture of disbelief and just the sheer exhaustion of having to prove it happened.
What's fascinating here is how the source reframes our understanding of that submerged section. We tend to view silence as a neutral state, but the material argues that silence does not equal an absence of harassment.
Right.
Rather, silence signals an absence of safety to speak.
Wow.
When targets of harassment withhold their experiences, it's generally not out of, like, an inherent desire to be secretive. It's a direct result of environmental feedback. The people and the culture around them simply haven't demonstrated that sharing the information will actually lead to support rather than further scrutiny.
Which pushes the reader into a potentially uncomfortable level of self-reflection. If silence is an active defense mechanism, the guide asks the reader to consider what well-meaning people might be doing to unintentionally reinforce those defensive walls.
Right. Though the text is careful to state that if a loved one hasn't discussed their experiences with you, it doesn't automatically mean you've done something malicious.
Sure. people withhold for lots of reasons.
Exactly. They might still be processing it themselves, or they might simply want to protect you from worrying. However, the guide introduces this concept of the unintentional silencer.
Yeah, and the primary example they give of an unintentional silencer is how we react to what we might classify as minor harassment.
Right.
Like if someone mentions getting catcalled and the listener just waves it off as an annoyance or like a clumsy compliment, the source argues that listener is functionally dismissing a genuine violation of safety.
And the text also emphasizes the role of intersectionality in these interactions, which is super important.
Oh, yeah.
The statistics show that individuals from marginalized demographics, so women of color, LGBTQ plus individuals, people with disabilities, they face compounding layers of harassment.
Right.
A woman of color, for instance, might be navigating misogyny that is inextricably linked with racism. And the guide points out that if a listener dismisses or fails to acknowledge one overlapping aspect of that threat, the entire conversation often just shuts down.
Because the listener has shown they don't grasp the full reality of the threat landscape.
Oh, exactly.
I do want to push back on one specific claim the guide makes in this section, though.
Oh, sure.
It suggests that casually debating a news story about harassment while, say, watching TV can permanently shut down a loved one's willingness to trust you with their own experiences.
Right.
I hear that. But how does someone differentiate between just having a philosophical debate in the living room and failing what the guide calls a trust litmus test?
Wait, so the guide is saying that just casually debating a news story the wrong way while watching TV can permanently shut down a loved one's willingness to trust you with their own experiences. Is playing devil's advocate really that dangerous to a relationship?
Oh, the psychology behind this is absolutely fascinating. We really have to look at the cognitive science of threat detection here.
Okay.
When someone experiences chronic boundary violations, their brain essentially rewires its threat assessment algorithms to be hyper-efficient.
They are constantly subconsciously gathering data points on the people around them. So when a news story comes on and you decide to play devil's advocate just as a, you know, a fun intellectual exercise, their brain doesn't register a philosophical debate.
It doesn't.
No, it registers a data point. It hears you say, well, maybe she shouldn't have been walking there. And the threat detection system immediately flags your default cognitive bias as skepticism.
Oh, man.
The brain categorizes you as an unsafe harbor because it extrapolates your reaction to a stranger and applies it to how you would react to them.
Okay, slow down the science for a second. Let me make sure I'm translating this. You're saying that from an evolutionary standpoint, the listener's brain isn't analyzing your debate skills.
Right.
It's projecting how your default skepticism would apply to their vulnerability.
They are running a simulation. If they share their deeply personal, perhaps slightly messy account of a harassment incident with you, they now have empirical evidence based on your living room debate that your first instinct will be to cross-examine them.
Wow. That makes so much sense.
The guide argues that the risk is simply too high. So the wall goes up. You've broadcasted your baseline level of empathy without even realizing you were taking a test.
So if our default reactions in casual debates are accidentally putting up walls, how do we actually go about building a bridge?
Yeah.
The HACCP material transitions here into a very specific phased approach for having the conversation, starting heavily with controlling the environment.
Yes. The framework emphasizes that the who, when, and where are just as important as the what.
Which is key.
Absolutely. The recommendation is to strictly practice this with someone where a foundation of mutual trust already exists. A partner, a sister, a close friend. You do not try to initiate this framework with a distant coworker or, like, an acquaintance.
And the timing is highly specific, too. The guide stresses finding a relaxed, private setting. It explicitly warns against bringing the topic up during a heated argument or in the immediate aftermath of a triggering news story.
Right, because the logic presented is that you need the other person's nervous system to be in a state of calm, not actively responding to stress.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the approach itself can be tailored, right?
It can. The direct approach involves stating your intentions clearly. You might say, I've been learning more about the realities of harassment and realized I have a blind spot. Would you be open to talking about your experiences?
I like that.
Or, alternatively, the indirect approach uses a prompt, perhaps a news story, but framed through curiosity rather than judgment. Like, this article made me realize how constant this issue is. What is your perspective on it?
But before any actual storytelling happens, the framework insists on establishing ground rules.
Crucial step.
Yeah, and the first rule is explicitly expanding the definition of harassment. You have to vocalize that you aren't just talking about worst-case scenarios of physical violence. You are opening the floor to talk about the creeping anxiety of being stared at, being followed, or dealing with subtle but unwanted comments.
And the psychological utility of that rule is that it preemptively removes the burden of proof from the speaker. They don't have to worry if their story is bad enough to warrant your attention. And the second critical ground rule is emphasizing choice.
Yeah, the choice is so important.
The guide advises stating up front that they don't have to share personal stories if they prefer not to. They can speak in generalities or talk about what friends have experienced. By explicitly giving them the power to control the depth of the disclosure, you restore a sense of agency that harassment inherently strips away.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the instinct, especially for men, is to be a mechanic.
Oh, yes.
To grab a wrench and try to fix the problem or offer safety tips like, oh, that guy bothered you on 4th Street. Next time, just tell him to back off.
Yeah.
Or why don't you walk down 5th Street instead? You want to fix the engine so the car stops breaking down.
Exactly.
But this guide is telling you to be a sponge.
Yeah.
Drop the wrench. Just absorb, listen, and validate.
That sponge versus mechanic analogy is just a perfect way to visualize the disconnect. And the source outlines the mechanisms of why the mechanic response fails so spectacularly in these moments.
Because it really does.
It does. When you offer tactical solutions like just take a different route, you are inadvertently minimizing the emotional impact of the violation. And more damagingly, you are subtly shifting the responsibility of prevention back onto the target.
Right. It becomes a retroactive critique of their survival skills.
Exactly.
And the guide warns against asking questions that sound like fact-checking. Things like, are you sure it happened exactly that way?
Mm-hmm.
Or, is it possible he was just trying to be friendly and it came off wrong?
Yeah, the source is emphatic on this point. Any form of interruption or minimization breaks that hard-won trust. The designated role for the listener is entirely passive absorption.
Just be the sponge.
Just be the sponge. The emotional relief provided by the sponge approach is profound because the speaker isn't looking for a bodyguard or a tactician in that moment. They are looking to externalize a heavy emotional weight without having to defend the validity of that weight.
And when the speaker does finish, the guide suggests the response should be incredibly brief.
Keep it simple.
Yeah, simply acknowledging and thanking them. Saying something to the effect of, I really appreciate you trusting me with that. I'm sorry you had to go through it. There is no grand speech required.
Right. And the framework also builds in a protocol for rejection.
Oh, this is a big one.
Yeah. If you ask if they are open to the conversation and they decline, the instruction is to drop it immediately and completely, saying, I understand. Thanks for letting me know. And I'm here if you ever do want to talk.
No pushing.
No pushing at all. The guide points out that perfectly respecting that boundary without showing frustration or defensiveness is in itself a demonstration that you are a safe harbor. You are proving that their no will be honored.
But all of this assumes that there is a level of verbal communication happening.
True.
The guide shifts gears to address a separate reality.
Yeah.
What if someone doesn't have a safe person to talk to?
Mm.
Or what if words simply fail to articulate the granular, exhausting reality of day-to-day hypervigilance?
Yeah.
And that brings us to the final section of the source material, making the invisible mental load visible.
The tool they introduce for this is called the mental load checklist.
Okay.
It's a structured activity designed to take about 15 to 20 minutes. It presents a comprehensive list of microbehaviors actions taken automatically, strictly for safety or harassment mitigation.
Right.
If applied within a relationship, the recommendation is for both individuals to fill it out separately and then lay the checklist side by side to compare the disparity in daily cognitive load.
And the reflection questions attached to the checklist are basically designed to quantify the invisible cost.
Yeah.
They ask, how long have these behaviors been normal for you? And which of these adaptations take the most energy, time, or money?
Because safety isn't an abstract feeling.
No. The material is trying to make the reader understand that safety is an active daily resource drain. It's calculating the financial cost of paying for a rideshare because the subway feels too isolated. It's the mental bandwidth spent gripping keys between fingers or constantly scanning the exits of a crowded room.
And to contextualize the physical and neurological toll of maintaining that checklist,
yeah.
The HASSL text includes direct quotes from their global survey respondents.
Yeah, I read those.
When asked to describe the internal experience of navigating this environment, the terminology used by the respondents is stark.
The words on the page are incredibly heavy. Respondents describe feeling sad, powerless, and diminished. Multiple people use the term hypervigilance. Some say they feel like an object rather than a person, while others simply write exhausted or dehumanized.
Right. From a physiological standpoint, maintaining a state of hypervigilance requires a near-constant drip of cortisol and adrenaline.
Wow.
It is an elevated stress response that never fully powers down. So when respondents say they are exhausted, they are describing genuine neurological fatigue.
Looking at the meta context of the source material raises an interesting question about their strategy, because Hassocel is a very small, self-funded, three-person organization.
They are.
They lack a traditional marketing apparatus, so they rely organically on people completing this course and sharing their certificates, or posting videos of themselves doing the mental load checklist on social media.
Right.
So evaluating the text objectively, is the goal of reading these heavy survey quotes and doing this checklist about shock value to drive social shares? Or is it fundamentally about forcing us to recalibrate what we've accepted as normal daily life?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the material structurally aligns with recalibration rather than mere shock value.
Yeah.
The text actively avoids using guilt as a motivator. It notes that guilt often leads to defensiveness or paralysis rather than constructive action.
That makes sense.
Yeah. By laying out the checklist, the material objectively exposes a radically uneven distribution of safety-related mental energy. The text argues that the burden of preventing harassment currently falls almost entirely on the potential targets. Making that invisible load visible is presented as the necessary first step to addressing the root behaviors, rather than just demanding targets become better at managing the symptoms.
So what does this all mean? If we zoom out and look at the trajectory of the framework we've unpacked today, the source argues that harassment thrives in a vacuum of silence, but that silence is a highly rational response to an environment that hasn't proven it is safe to speak.
Right.
It suggests that our casual reactions, our living room debates, and our dismissals of minor incidents are constantly acting as subconscious data points that either build or break trust.
And the material posits that mastering the ability to listen without intervening, putting down the mechanic's wrench and becoming the sponge, is a vital communicative skill. It requires overriding the instinct to fix a situation in favor of validating the emotional reality of the person experiencing it.
The core takeaway seems to be that effective support isn't about grand sweeping public declarations. Mm-hmm. It's about acknowledging the granular, invisible mental load that others are carrying and being willing to sit in the quiet discomfort of those conversations so that they don't have to carry that weight in isolation.
For you listening, the practical application of this framework offers a direct mechanism to alter the dynamics of your own relationships.
Yeah.
The guide makes the case that when an individual realizes they no longer have to curate or edit their lived reality around you, the baseline level of intimacy and trust deepens significantly. You actively become a safe harbor.
It is a framework that asks for a massive shift in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And evaluating the source material leaves me with one final thought. Something that builds on the concept of the checklist that I just haven't been able to stop turning over in my head.
What's that?
Well, if sitting down for 20 minutes and reviewing the HSL mental load checklist can so radically alter the empathy and understanding of a single individual or reshape the dynamic of one couple, imagine the cascading effects if the urban planners, the architects, and the municipal policymakers who actually design our physical environments were required to take it.
Oh, wow.
Right. How fundamentally differently would our cities, our lighting grids, and our public transit systems be built if the invisible mental load of safety was finally made visible to the people drawing the blueprints?